What do you do when you're blue? I asked this question last week for a very specific reason. I was blue. And I know what I do when I'm blue. I avoid people. I don't want people around. I don't want to bother with them. I don't want to say hello to them. I don't want to be nice to them. I don't want to talk to them. I don't want to answer their questions. And because apparently I am rather easily read, people recognize when I'm blue. 2 days before I taught class last Sunday, on Friday morning, I had breakfast with two men, and I had hardly been seated. I was hardly even there when one of them said something to the effect that, "You seem troubled, distant today." I just want to be left alone. I want to sit and feel blue. I want to be down. I want to hurt. I want to be fearful. I want to be angry. I want to be able to say what I want to say, and I don't want anyone pointing out things to me. Things like the sovereignty of God. Not at all interested in that. I was blue for two reasons. First, because someone very important to me was going through some pain, and I had tried to prevent it. I had said to that one, "If you will do this, 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 and this, that won't happen." Unfortunately, that one didn't do this, 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 and this, so that happened. And I blame myself. I felt I failed. I had let this one down. I just hadn't stepped in at the right time. I just hadn't done the right thing. I just hadn't gotten across my point. I failed. That's how I felt. And one of the things I've learned across the years is that the more you love, the more easily and the more deeply you are hurt. Love is a risk, and love will make you blue. The other reason was because I was stressed out. I serve on the board of an organization that has an annual event on a particular weekend each year, and that event occurred last weekend, and it meant a Friday night gathering, and it meant being in meetings all day long Saturday, all day long Saturday. It meant crunching my preparation for this class into a few open spots, even in the middle of a meeting, sitting on the back row, where they probably thought I was taking notes on what was being said. However, Linda, who was with me, said, "I didn't think you were taking that many notes." And then it meant Saturday night, and then it meant Sunday morning before I came here, and then it meant Sunday afternoon after I left here. And I just didn't want to be there. Now, I love the organization. And the people are involved are some of the people that I enjoy being with the most, and I usually look forward to being with these people. But I didn't want to be there. I just wanted to be blue. So another thing I've learned: to be alive is to hurt. You will not avoid hurt. Now, no matter what you do, you're not going to avoid it, but boy, at the same time, I think we all ought to do everything we can to avoid it. There is no reason to stand in line for pain, okay? You put a sign over a window that says, "Pain available here," and I will avoid that line. I will end up there sooner or later, but I'm going to avoid it. And part of the scriptures is written to help me avoid it. But to be alive is to hurt. There's something else, though, I've discovered. It's okay to hurt. I think that's a problem with a lot of Christians. I want to get to that in just a moment. But before I do, I think there are other reasons why we get blue. Not just because someone we love has done something that we wish could have been avoided. Oh, and by the way, after some thought, a few days later, I finally put it together. I remembered some conversations I had had And I remembered the other part of that conversation, if you do this, 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 and this, that won't happen. I remembered also saying, however, I'm not going to do any more than this because I think you have to make your own decisions. I remembered saying that. And so, I guess I didn't fail. I just didn't succeed. Sometimes that's all you can do. You can try not to fail, but you won't succeed. Because, you see, we just can't control each other, can we? Well, anyway, I've thought about other reasons why I've been blue in my life, why I've been stressed out, why I've been depressed at times. And I think that one of the reasons why we often feel pain is because we feel limited, and we feel limited by God. We don't like God's limits in our lives. That's why we feel pain often. God puts limits on us. We don't like those limits. For me, there was a time when I expected my ministry to be bigger than it was. For you, it may be that you expected your fortune to be bigger than it is. There was a time when I expected my fame to be greater, and it became. It may be that you expected your influence to be greater. There was a time when I expected my impact to be stronger. You may have expected your power to be stronger. There was a time when I expected God's will to be better for me. You may have had the same feeling. I remember when I was in San Jose and we were starting a church, and it was a small operation. It never really was a struggling operation. I can't say that, but it was small. And there were people who would drive 45 minutes past my church to go hear Ray Steadman every Sunday, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, and that was very depressing. I remember one fellow who came, and the first Sunday he was there, I mean, he just jumped all over me, because I wasn't Ray Steadman, and they all wanted tape recordings of Ray Steadman and things like that. And I was very depressing, and I was very unhappy about all of that. And I remember waking up one day and thinking to myself, I wasn't getting out of bed. I mean, it's like in the middle of the day. I'm even, not even sure where I was. I was living in San Jose. I'd always wanted to live in the Bay Area ever since I first went there. I was living in a tract house there. It was a nice house, you know, not custom built, but still a nice house. And I could look out my windows in every direction, and I could see hills. And when we first moved there, there were cattle. They were running cattle on the hills just 1,000 feet from our house, and it was green belted. And I could wake up and see deer out my window in the early morning. And I could look out my study, and I could look up a draw into a beautiful green hill with scrub oak. And I suddenly realized I didn't like God's will for me. I liked where I lived, but I didn't like some of the aspects of it. I really was critical of God's will for me, and I suddenly realized that down in my heart, this arrogant attitude was there, which was God's will wasn't good enough for me. I expected better for me than God was giving me. And you know, that attitude, that arrogance, brought pain into my life. Because I found myself limited by God. You may feel that way about your marriage. I've met a lot of people who do. You know, I meet them when it's God's will to marry, and then I meet them when it wasn't God's will to marry. Same person. Really not much change, just some reality that seeped in there somehow. Yeah. But I'll tell you one other thing I've learned about being blue. One is, if you love, you're going to get hurt. Two is, it's okay to hurt. Because that's the only way you grow. Three is, I'm not going to deny when I've been hurt. I'm not going to sit at that table and pass it off to my friends and say, oh, I just didn't get much sleep. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to play the Christian game. Because I despise the Christian game. See, the Christian game is a game played by many, perhaps even most Christians, who seem to think that it's a sin to feel distressed or be depressed. They feel that if they admit they're hurting, if they admit they're feeling blue, if they admit they're stressed out or struggling, they'll let the Lord down. And it's not that they'll let the Lord down, they'll let their face down. They're going to lose face. It's a real issue. I think it's more important personally to be real Christians than to be good Christians. I think the world is tired of good Christians. It would love to meet some real Christians. You know, when I'm talking about a good Christian, I'm talking about somebody who just sort of comes around all the time with that Christian look. I'm so happy I'm a Christian, and they can see you coming 100 miles away. What they're looking for is what we're like when we have to go to the grave. Because you know the thing that's really going to impact the worldling? It's the resurrection that always follows the grave for people who know Jesus Christ. It's the growth. It's the development. It's the timber. It's the reality. It's the presence. It's the consistency. It's the admiration that comes when someone says, I've seen you hurt and I know you hurt and you didn't deny that you hurt, but what I saw was something happen in you and through you that I've never seen anywhere else. We need to be real rather than fitting a mold. It is actually possible to be joyous in the midst of tension and hurt and pain. And today I'm going to introduce you to the first of three men, all of whom are facing death. Each of these men is facing death. Each of these men is not only facing death, but only one of them is facing death legitimately. We will meet him today. The other two are facing death unnecessarily. They should not be facing this death. The other two are facing death in the sovereign hand of God. All three are, but the other two are facing death in the sovereign hand of God. They're looking at the ultimate limitation coming from the hand of God. The first man should be depressed, but he isn't. The other has been, but isn't. And the third is in the midst of it. We're only going to meet the first man today. He's the same man we met last week. He is David. We're going to look at David today, and we're going to come to a different passage of Scripture. We're going to come to a passage of Scripture that I personally discovered some years ago, 1 Chronicles 29. I can't remember exactly when I discovered it, but it was at a time when I'm wrestling with myself, when I'm wrapped up inside, feeling some of the issues that I felt as I'm trying to sort out what God is doing with me, why these limitations are in my life, why isn't my ministry going better, why aren't I seeing more of what I thought I was going to see, how come none of this is going on? And I came upon 1 Chronicles chapter 29. David, as we pointed out last week, has already learned to be honest with God. That's the beginning point. That's the beginning point for all effectiveness for us as Christians. You know what? I want to tell you something. When we as Christians are phony to the worldlings, it's because we're phony with God. We're playing a cover-up game with God. That's why we come across as unreal to the worldlings. People who come into the presence of God and who reveal themselves and who speak with honesty and integrity before God and don't try to hide things from Him, which is impossible to do, those people become real. They become themselves. And David has learned to do this. He has spent a lifetime learning how to do this. Remember I said to you last week that there are four words involved in dealing with being blue. Honesty, sovereignty, humility, joy. You know, the most amazing thing we're going to discover about three men facing death is that each of them speak about joy. And by the way, I think personally it is possible to struggle with depression and have joy at the same time. Because joy is not an emotion dependent on something that happens in our lives. Joy is a relationship that sustains us and strengthens us in the midst of grief, in the midst of hurt, in the midst of rejection, in the midst of pain. It's what you come to at the bottom of it all when you've gone down, down, down into the pit of being blue, and you get down to the bottom, there is a bottom, and you suddenly discover the foundation and you find out God is there. That's what joy is. It's getting to the bottom of the pit and discovering God. Because I want to tell you something, there's no depth you can ever go to in your emotions of struggle and hurt and pain where God will not be deeper than that. And so we come to David. David is facing the depression of natural death. He should be depressed. He's coming to the end of his life. And not only is he facing the depression of natural death, but what should really be bothering him is that the dream of his life has been denied by God. God has stepped into his life and said, David, you have a dream, and I'm going to deny you that dream. You're not going to experience it. You're not going to fulfill it. You will never have that dream. Now, let me help you to understand what that dream is. It wasn't the dream of being, you know, filthy rich. He didn't set out to become the richest man on the face of the earth. It wasn't the dream of having awesome power. He didn't desire that he should have more power than anybody else in the world. It wasn't that dream. It wasn't the dream of being some vast, great star. That wasn't his driving desire. He didn't set out to rise to the pinnacle, to be on the cover of all the magazines and to have everybody in the world recognize him. That wasn't his dream. You'd understand if God would deny the self-centered dream of wealth or power or stardom. Those things you'd understand if God were to deny an individual that. But you know what the dream of David's life was? It's to build a temple for God. That was the dream of David's life. David's dream was to erect in honor of God a temple. In fact, he was motivated by the fact that he lived in a house that a king had built for him, a nearby king, the king of Tyre. Hiram was his name. He had built for David and out of admiration for David. And he lived in this house set on a hilltop in Jerusalem. And he happened to look out one day and he saw this tent. That's what the tabernacle is. The word tabernacle is a fancy word for tent. And he saw this tent, though kept in repair, is now 400 years old. And that's where God, quote unquote, lived. How would you like to live in a 400-year-old tent? And David was embarrassed. He was ashamed. And he said to Nathan the prophet, his religious advisor, was in to see him one day. He said, Nathan, I'm going to build a temple for God. And, you know, if someone walked into my office and said, hey, look, Bill, here's what we want to do. We want to renovate your entire building. We want to bring this building up to the place of phenomenal beauty. I'll tell you, it wouldn't take me very long at all to say, all right! And I'd say it then, and as soon as the person would leave my office, I'd be running all over our office. And the people who work with me know this. I'd be running into every office. Guess what just happened? Guess what just happened? I'd be going nuts. Nathan did too. Until he went home and talked with God, or rather God talked with him. And God said, Nathan, I want you to go back and tell David no. This is in 1 Samuel 7. I'm not going there. I'll just tell you where it is. Go back and tell him no, Nathan the prophet. So he goes back and he tells David no, and he tells him why. David, you were not born to build a temple. You were born to build a nation. You were not born to erect a temple to honor God. You were born to fight a war and to consolidate the nation of Israel. That's why you were born. And because you have been born to be a man who sheds blood, you will not build a temple for me. And what God said to David is, I have a purpose for you that is clearly defined and that is significant, but it limits you and you'll never fulfill your life dream. That's one of the problems we have. Often we start out focused on a particular dream only to discover after a period of time that that's not the purpose God has for us. He didn't create us for that purpose. He didn't give us those talents. He didn't give us those abilities. And some of us are depressed because we're not becoming what we thought we would become, but God never intended for us to become that. We're pursuing a wrong dream. God said no to David. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 29, we come to the end of David's life. And one of the things that we see at the end of David's life is that David has made peace with this denial. He has accepted God's limitation in his life. He has agreed with this. And what he is going to teach us is this. In 1 Chronicles chapter 29, beginning at verse 10, David is going to teach us God is sovereign. Now, why do I say this to you? Because I want you to understand this. You must come, if you are going to gain perspective in the midst of being blue, in the midst of stress, in the midst of depression, you must come to the place where you honestly walk into the presence of God, and if you're angry with Him, you say you're angry with Him. And if you're fearful, you say you're fearful. And if you're tense, you say you're tense. You pour out to God whatever it is that is harming and hurting you. And you let that be known. And then you are ready to understand the sovereignty of God. And so you go from honesty to sovereignty. And this is what David does. 1 Chronicles 29 at verse 10. So David blessed the Lord, gave thanks to the Lord, praised the Lord in the sight of all the assembly. Let me tell you what's happening. David has not been allowed to build the temple, but he has been allowed to fund the temple. He's designed it. And he's raised the funds. The people are bringing in all of their gifts in order for these gifts to be turned into the ability to buy the materials to build the temple. But Solomon is the one who will build it. And so David stands in the presence of all these people and he says, "Blessed are you, O Lord, O Lord God of Israel, our Father forever and ever." Now begin at verse 11. "Thine, O Lord," and I want you to look with me, I'm going to take you through all the words in this verse. There's a pattern in David's writing, and it shows up in his prayer. It's one of the patterns that the Hebrews used to communicate emphasis. And what they would do is this. They would take a concept, and they'd take a synonym, and they'd build on it, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one, and they just build it all the way up. And what he's trying to do is to describe the indescribable God by taking synonym after synonym after synonym for the sovereignty of God. Let's look at them, and let's understand them. "Thine, O Lord, is the greatness." That is, you are the greatest. You all. Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay. I'm the greatest. That's an attitude that pervades sports today. That's an attitude that pervades business today. That's an attitude that pervades our world today. And I want to tell you something. These people, including us, who think somehow we're the greatest at something. We are a mere shadow, as David will climax in a bit. He is the greatest. And the focus is on the most important. You are. He begins by saying, you are the greatest in terms of being the most important person in the universe. But it's more than that. Yours also is the power, the capacity to act. God is omnipotent. Human strength is nothing. He is strongest who has discovered the finite limitations of his own capacities in the light of the limitless resources of God through his Spirit. We are strongest when we realize God is omnipotent. And we are fortunate, almost, if I can be non-theological, lucky, that God ever even has given us the time of day. His is the greatness. His is the power. His is the glory. This is used only of God, this particular term. It focuses on the beauty of who He is. His is an overwhelming beauty, better than a $1,500 Italian suit. Dress us up in the best you can find, and we don't even compare to God. His is the victory. And it's interesting. The primary focus of this word for victory is really on God's ability to endure. Have you ever gone in negotiations with somebody who can just sit at the table forever and ever 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 and ever? Think what it's like to negotiate with somebody like that. And you see, first this one quit, and then that one quits, and then this one quits, and then that one. He wins just because he can sit at the table longer than anybody else. Well, I want you to understand something. God can sit at the table longer than anybody. Because when we're gone, he's still there. If it were not for his power, if it were not for his knowledge, if it were not for his justice, if it were not for his righteousness, if it were only for God's endurance alone, he'd win just because he outlasts everybody else. God has the victory. The victory belongs to him. Not only that, but he possesses the majesty, another term for God's glory. And the idea here is really that he wears his majesty as a wardrobe. And guess what his majesty is? It's not a $1,500 Italian suit. His majesty is the sun, the moon, the stars, the sky, the universe, the planets, time and space. He wears them all as mere decorations. The majesty of God. Stop and think for just a moment. What are you striving for in life? Tell me your bottom line. I'll bet you. Now, forgive me if I project myself on you, but I've spent enough time with people who come to this class to think that we sort of belong in the club together. I'll bet you it's greatness, power, glory, victory, and majesty. I'll bet there's a few people in this room living for that. I want to tell you something. This is the cause for feeling blue very often. This is why we feel so depressed. We're trying to get something that isn't ours to have. It doesn't belong to us. It's not ours by right. We want what only God can have. It all belongs to God. You know how you're going to get it? Let me tell you how you're going to get it. You get it as you get close to God. The closer you get to God, what you'll discover is he will let you enjoy the shadow of his greatness. He will let you experience a tad of his majesty. He will let you express a touch of his glory. He will let you actually establish some of his victory. This is my burden for us in this class. That we would come close to the greatness of God. Because in discovering and coming close to the greatness of God in prayer, in worship, in obedience to His Holy Spirit, that's how you do it. You pray, you worship, you be in the Word, you understand what the Word says, you go out and you try to do it in the power of the Holy Spirit. You come back to the end of the day, you report for duty, and you tell Him how you failed, and He cleans you up and He sends you out the next day. That's what life is like. But in the midst of that, as you come close to God's greatness, you will enter into the greatness that He has for you. Now David comes back to his, or I come back to David's prayer rather. Look what he says next. He said that, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty." Now he's run out of words, so he says, "Indeed, everything. You are the whole thing." That's what he says. You are it. You are all there is. Everything that is in the heavens and the earth, all of it belongs to you. Yours is the dominion. Here we discover that the focus of this word is on God's kingship. And he talks also about rule. And these two words are closely related, and they emphasize the principle of God's authority in the world. And he goes on to say something else. He tells us that God exalts himself as head over all. And in verse 12, he shifts to us. Look what he says. Both riches and honor come from you. You rule over all. This is the essence of God's sovereignty. You want riches? You want honor? Submit yourself to the rulership of God and let Him give you what He wants you to have. Seek no more. You will get no less. And you will find in that your identity. Riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all, and in your hand is power and might. That's where power is. That's where might is. It is in the hand of God. And if it is for you, it will be yours. And if it is not for you, you can strive for it. You can struggle for it. You can reach for it. You can grasp for it. You can do work for it. You can do everything. And you may even get it, but you will get it. And it will be fleeting. And it will destroy you. It will destroy your family. It will destroy your health. And it will bring your life down to a crashing, ugly close. There will be no glory at the end of life. He has in His hand the capacity to make great and to strengthen everyone. You see, the point David is making is this: God alone is sovereign, and God alone can strengthen us in our stress. God alone is sovereign, and that's where you must come. And often our stress is the product of our ambition of going against the ceiling and the walls of God's limitations on our lives. The greatest discovery I have ever made. And I remember, by the way, when my wife said to me something about the sovereignty of God one day. That made me kind of mad inside. Because she brought me up short. It's a pattern she has at times. Her greatest contribution to my life, among many. Because I hadn't thought about the sovereignty of God. I was too focused on me. And I have discovered this: the greatest release in my life has come by accepting the limitations of God upon me. Things I have wanted in the past, I no longer want. And when they go to someone else, I can be happy for that person. There are some citadels remaining to fall. Time and eternity will take care of them. But the greatest joy in life is living within God's limits. God's limits for you are so unbelievably freeing, you will never know who you are until you learn to live within those limits. Then comes freedom. Then comes identity. And that's where David goes, because you see, what David demonstrates for us is the humility we need to have. As David prays, we now see the honesty in this man, now different from the honesty we saw last week, which was the honesty of a man coming to God with a complaint. Now we see the honesty of a man who comes to God having submitted to the limitations. And in that honesty, he turns and he says, "Now therefore, our God, we thank you and praise your glorious name," in verse 13. David has responded by submitting himself in thanksgiving to God for the limitations of his experience. And now he teaches us something else, and I think this is really significant. Twice in two verses, in verses 14 and 16, David teaches us the reality: we give to God only what He has given to us. And until we accept what God has given us, we have nothing to give to God but anger and bitterness and resentment and pain and questions. But he says, look in verse 14, "But who am I?" This is, now we move to this intense humility. We move from honesty to humility. Look at his intense humility. "But who am I? And who are my people that we should be able to offer as generously as this? Who are we that we should have this privilege, even though I'm being denied what I want? For all things come from thee, and from thy hand we have given thee." And back down, go down to verse 16. He says, "O Lord our God, all this abundance that we have provided to build a house for you, for your holy name, is from your hand, and all of it is yours." My dear friends, take your house. Think about your house for a moment. Just picture it in your mind. See it? See your car? See your office? See the trophies of achievement? All of those come from God. All of those belong to God. None of those belong to you. Not one of those things. They are a gift of grace from God. And David says, unless we realize this, we're going to miss the point of verse 15. "For we are sojourners before you. We are just tenants. We are just passing through." See? Tenants. He uses that very word. And he says, "Our days on earth are like a shadow and there is no hope." What does he mean? He doesn't mean that he doesn't have hope. That's not the point. The point of the matter is that when David says our days on earth are like a shadow, compared to God, God is the substance. We are the shadow. And what David means is there's no hope that that's ever going to change. If you're trying to be God, forget it. You're never going to make it. There is hope for shadows. We can be turned into God's substance, not to become gods, but that God in us would make us His living temple and we can live ways that please Him. But there is no hope apart from the substance of God. And finally, David says the key word that I want to get to in verse 17. Since I know, O God, that you try the heart and delight in uprightness, I in the integrity of my heart, you have tested me, you have tried me, and I'm aware of that, and I've tried to deal with everything in my heart that would keep me from being what you want me to be, and as far as I can tell, I'm okay before you, and in the integrity of my heart, to the best of my awareness, I have willingly offered you all of this, the ultimate bounty of my entire life and my kingdom. And so now, with joy, I have seen your people present here make their offerings willingly to you. The man is facing physical death with the dream of his life denied. But he says, I have joy. I bring with joy. And remember that this joy is not an external feeling, the result of a fun time. This joy is from deep within, from the heart, from the soul, not a temporary forgetting, not a cover-up for the hard moments of pain I face, but a total whole being response. This is the joy of the Lord. This is the joy and confidence that God is pleased with what the man has done with his life. Let me ask you this. Give you a choice. Which do you want at the end of your life? To have all of the acknowledgement and praise of men, die rich, and declare bankruptcy in eternity. Or to have that which God has provided for you, which will be plenty, and step across into eternity, into an eternal fortune. Which do you want? How are you living? The way you live tells you what you want. And what we need to understand is this. When we're blue, there is a joy available to us. It's a joy that comes out of obedience, out of growth, out of achievement, that will take us into times of hurt and pain. And in the midst of that hurt and that pain, this joy is available. And the way we find it is to come to the Word and worship God with honesty, recognizing we will face His sovereignty, with humility, leaving that Word to go and discover that joy, that deep sense of the abiding presence, provision, and reality of God in the midst of our lives. This doesn't always relieve the pain, but it does release us from the anger. And it tells us, in the midst of this time, God will walk with us. What do you want? How are you living? God alone is sovereign, and He alone can sustain you in your stress.